Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Concerns have been raised over anti-Semitic and anti-LGBT flyers distributed in some neighborhoods in San Diego and East County. We'll have details on our show today. A livestock disease that started in East County has now spread through six California counties, and we'll have an update for you on vesicular stomatitis virus. La Mesa City Council has voted for a gun safety law after a contentious hearing. We'll have details on these hot local stories, and then we'll take you on the road to discover some adventures in San Diego County's unincorporated backcountry. That's our rural, mountain, desert, and tribal communities. Our newsmaker interviews today are with Barbara Cummins, Pat Stratton, and Lynn, who asked that her last name not be aired. They'll be sharing concerns over gaps in coverage to help the many refugees from around the world who now call San Diego County home. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
La Mesa City Council has approved a draft ordinance requiring residents in most circumstances to keep guns locked up or disabled with a trigger lock. Following a contentious hearing, the measure was approved by a 3-2 vote, with council members Jack Hsu, Colin Parent, and Patricia Dillard in favor. Council members Laura Lothian, Mayor Mark Arapatasis voted no. A similar measure was shot down last year by a 3-2 margin. This time, council member Dillard, who filled the vacancy filled by the retirement of Bill Bader, reintroduced the measure and cast the deciding vote. The County of San Diego already has a safe storage gun law in effect for unincorporated areas, as do the cities of San Diego, Solana Beach, Encinitas, and Del Mar. The hearing in La Mesa drew 23 speakers, with 17 opposed to the measures and 6 in support. Dillard said, "The proposed law aims to prevent burglars from stealing guns and to keep children safe from firearms in the home." But Lothian argued that the law would make it harder for adults to swiftly retrieve firearms to save their own lives in an emergency. However, the La Mesa law does include 2 exceptions, allowing an unlocked gun if it's carried by an authorized user or is close by, quote, so that the person can readily retrieve and use the firearm. Michael Schwartz, executive director of San Diego County Gun Owners, argued that the law would be unconstitutional. He stated that there is no historical basis for the government to enter someone's home and dictate how their firearms are stored. Cajon Valley Union School Board President Jim Miller spoke against the ordinance and mocked Councilman Hsu for wearing an orange shirt in solidarity with the gun safety movement. But Brianna Costin, a member of the La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, one of several people to recount a friend's gun suicide. Some speakers displayed violent imagery. One woman wore a shirt with a bomb image, and another critic wore a t-shirt showing AR-15s. One speaker, Blake Beckham, threatened to work to defeat anyone who voted for the measure. Lauren Cazares, a member of the city's police oversight board and a candidate for La Mesa City Council, said her parents were NRA members and her grandfather was a gun collector, but she believes the law is needed and urged the council to enact it now, rather than waiting for a tragedy. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the network for social justice, this is Derek Wilton.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. The vesicular stomatitis virus, or VSV, outbreak in livestock that began in San Diego County back in May has now spread to encompass 6 California counties. One county in Texas also had a single confirmed case on a property, but it's been released from quarantine. Species affected locally include primarily equine species such as horses, though 2 local sites have had cattle infected and 1 San Diego location has had clinically infected rhinoceros. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture does not identify which specific properties or communities have confirmed or suspected cases. Our news outlet did send an email request to inquire whether the San Diego Zoo or Safari Park may be impacted, but they have not responded. Locally, 31 properties in San Diego County are currently under quarantine, while 37 properties have been released from quarantine. A total of 26 positive cases of VSV have been confirmed here, by far the most of any county. Elsewhere in California, Riverside County has had 7 confirmed cases and currently has 14 properties quarantined. San Bernardino County has 3 confirmed cases and 5 quarantined properties due to actual or suspected cases. Los Angeles County has 4 properties quarantined but just 1 confirmed case. And Orange County has 1 property quarantined with 1 confirmed case. Now, the good news is that quarantines and other measures implemented appear to be slowing the spread of the virus. In the prior week, from June 30th to July 7th, only 1 new property has been added to the quarantine list here in San Diego County, with just 1 confirmed new case. Though not usually fatal, the VSV disease causes severe blister-like lesions on the mouths, hooves, and sometimes other areas in livestock, including equines such as horses and donkeys, as well as cattle, pigs, sheep, goats, llamas, and others. The disease takes about 2 weeks to run its course, though lesions can take up to 2 months to clear up. There is no cure, but treatments are available for infection and to reduce discomfort, since the disease often makes it painful for the animals to eat or walk. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control lists several wildlife species that rarely have also been confirmed with VSV. These include deer, raccoons, rodents, feral pigs, and bobcats. Animals can contract the disease from bites by black flies, midges, sandflies, and possibly other insects. VSV can also spread through shared water or feed and through contact with shared surfaces. The disease can spread to humans, but usually it causes only flu-like symptoms in people, such as fever and fatigue. Facilities should protect livestock through fly control and sanitizing methods to avoid spread of the disease. All suspected cases must be reported to health authorities, and animals with suspected or confirmed cases must be isolated until a veterinarian deems that they are no longer contagious.
La Mesa City Council has approved a draft ordinance requiring residents in most circumstances to keep guns locked up or disabled with a trigger lock. Following a contentious hearing, the measure was approved by a 3-2 vote, with council members Jack Hsu, Colin Parent, and Patricia Dillard in favor. Council members Laura Lothian and Mayor Mark Arapatasis voted no. A similar measure was shot down last year by a 3-2 margin. This time, Council Member Dillard reintroduced the measure and cast the deciding vote. The County of San Diego already has a safe storage gun law in effect for unincorporated areas, as do the cities of San Diego, Solana Beach, Encinitas, and Del Mar. The hearing in La Mesa drew 23 speakers, with 17 opposed to the measures and 6 in support. Dillard said, "The proposed law aims to prevent burglars from stealing guns and to keep children safe from firearms in the home." But Lothian argued that the law would make it harder for adults to swiftly retrieve firearms to save their own lives in an emergency. However, the La Mesa law does include 2 exceptions, allowing an unlocked gun if it's carried by an authorized user or is close by, quote, so that the person can readily retrieve and use the firearm. Michael Schwartz, executive director of San Diego County Gun Owners, argued that the law would be unconstitutional. He stated that there is no historical basis for the government to enter someone's home and dictate how their firearms are stored. Cajon Valley Union School Board President Jim Miller spoke against the ordinance and mocked Councilman Hsu for wearing an orange shirt in solidarity with the gun safety movement. But Brianna Costin, a member of the La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, one of several people to recount a friend's gun suicide. Some speakers displayed violent imagery. One woman wore a shirt with a bomb image, and another critic wore a t-shirt showing AR-15s. One speaker, Blake Beckham, threatened to work to defeat anyone who voted for the measure. Lauren Cazares, a member of the city's police oversight board and a candidate for La Mesa City Council, said her parents were NRA members and her grandfather was a gun collector, but she believes the law is needed and urged the council to enact it now, rather than waiting for a tragedy. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Derek Wilton.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery taking you on the road to San Diego County's backcountry, which includes rural, mountain, and desert communities. Our unincorporated backcountry area, though seemingly quiet, is actually alive with opportunities for adventure and local events. Aside from the lure of the open road on one of San Diego's most scenic highways, such as oak and boulder-studded Old Highway 80 or beautiful State Route 79, there are barbecues, fairs, country markets, art and music shows, farms open for tours, yard sales, horseback riding, and a shimmering lake tucked into the scenery along the way. San Diego's backcountry offers Airbnb experiences in towns such as Campbell, Boulevard, Guate, Descanso, Julian, Pine Valley, and Hacumba Hot Springs, or you can stay at the more than century-old Julian Hotel. There are also plenty of opportunities to try new things and meet new friends. How about family-friendly karaoke night every Thursday at Pine Valley House in Pine Valley? Or maybe you're craving a lively country-flavored concert. Where Highways 79 and 80 meet in the village of Descanso, the Junction Outback is a wild outdoors venue behind the Descanso Junction restaurant. They celebrate summer there with live music every Friday and Saturday night in the summer months. Guate Mountain Native Plant Nursery in Guate, between Descanso and Pine Valley, makes a beautiful stop on the weekend along a sunny drive on Old Highway 80. And nearby, you'll find the Treon Wooden Spoon Gallery, a treat to visit with its art glass and wooden spoon collection. Lake Cuyamaca on Highway 79, heading into Julian, is beautiful any time of year, with fishing, hiking, and glimpses of wildlife from deer to bald eagles. The popular pub at Lake Cuyamaca offers a lake view dining experience. The kids' trout fishing derby there is planned in September, where fishing in the pines has become an exciting yearly gathering with picnicking and a slew of prizes. If you venture further up Highway 79 to Julian, a historic gold rush town famous for its apple pie, you can stroll its quaint streets and choose from several great eateries, try your hand at gold panning, or take a tour of the California Wolf Center nestled in the hills nearby. Or venture up Sunrise Highway toward Mount Laguna, a popular destination for snowgoers in winter as well as campers in spring, summer, and fall. Mount Laguna is one of the first camping areas that Pacific Crest trail hikers encounter along their trek. Hacumba Hot Springs, 29 miles southeast of Pine Valley, at the farthest reaches in San Diego's backcountry, is enjoying a rebirth of popularity with a bazaar the first Saturday each month from 10 to 2 at the old bathhouse landmark in the center of town. Visiting musicians also play there to stars and candlelight. Now, folks can catch an art exhibit, too, at the old bathhouse, or visit Gilliam Gallery across the highway after strolling along the lakes and dunes. The Hacumba Hot Springs Hotel has recently been renovated and reopened. The Desert View Tower, just east of Hacumba, near the Imperial County line, is a cherished landmark and camping spot overlooking the desert above Ocotillo. Its famous Boulder Park provides a rare adventure with hidden trails, caves, and charming rock carvings. Further east, Anza Borrego Desert State Park, which is partly in San Diego County, provides wildflower viewing in spring, hiking, a visitor center, famous resorts, golf, bighorn sheep to see, whimsical sculptures, and stargazing after dark. Along I-8 and Alpine, you can stop to dine at local restaurants or enjoy a cold beer at a brewery. The Viejas Native American Reservation in Alpine has an outlet center with bowling and an arcade for the kids, as well as a casino and hotels. Other Native American reservations in East County offer attractions ranging from casinos to campgrounds, golf, restaurants, and at Barona in Lakeside, a Native American cultural museum. In late summer, Barona and Sequan host powwows with competitions featuring Native American dancers, drummers, bird singers, and vendors. You can also savor wine tasting at the many wineries in the Ramona wine region, as well as wineries in other areas such as Campo and Jamul. Campo is also home to the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, where you can take a ride aboard a historic train. Ramona also has a camel dairy and the historic Guy B. Woodward Museum. Drop down Highway 78 to cruise through Lakeside, which is home to several county parks for scenic hikes, as well as the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. Exploring San Diego's backcountry is popular with individuals and families. Our backcountry is also a favorite destination for motorcycle and classic car clubs. Bicyclists also take advantage of the route they call the Southern Tour on their way to the east coast of the U.S. Besides year-round attractions, many towns in East County's backcountry also have unique festivals, parades, deep pit barbecues, and other special events that you can find on our calendar at eastcountymagazine.org. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today we're going to be talking about refugees. San Diego in recent years has taken in more refugees than any other city in California, which in turn takes in the second most refugees in the nation. San Diego County has the third highest Iraqi immigrant population in the U.S. and the second highest number of Afghan refugees in America. And in the last 2 years, almost 3,000 refugees have come here from around the world. Now, there are four official agencies in charge of refugee resettlement locally, but the needs of these families are overwhelming, and too often, many of those needs are not being met to help them get an education, good-paying jobs, all the things they need to sustain them once those short-term resettlement funds run out. So today, I am delighted to be interviewing three women who have been actively helping local refugees whose needs are not always being met by the agencies. They are Barbara Cummings, Pat Stratton, and Lynn, who asked that her full name not be aired. So, ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. I'm so happy to be here and have the opportunity to speak with you and the community about our refugees in San Diego.
Yes, I'd also like to just echo what Barbara said. Thank you for allowing us this opportunity to advocate for a very important community that's near and dear to our hearts, but also very deserving of the support and the resources of fellow San Diegans.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you for having us today. I think it's very important that the community understands just what the refugees are facing and the importance of supporting them in their new environment.
So, Lynn, you're a community volunteer with a professional background in nonprofit leadership and social work. I understand you've worked in both professional and volunteer capacities with marginalized populations, including unhoused transitional aged youths, survivors of intimate partner violence, people in complex medical need, and unaccompanied migrant children. After the fall of Kabul, Afghanistan, Lynn, you initially sought volunteer opportunities to contribute in-kind donations to refugee households. And in building relationships with these families, I understand you're now focused on supporting self-sufficiency to assure long-term safety and well-being for our refugee neighbors in San Diego. So can you start by explaining to us how is the refugee resettlement process outlined on the county's Health and Human Services website for refugees who've arrived in San Diego?
Sure. Thank you for asking. So I initially encountered an Afghan refugee family in the medical setting. I was trying to assist them in a professional capacity to ensure that their medically fragile child received the services that they needed. And in doing so, I discovered that what was happening at that point, in talking with this family, I was quite surprised that they were not receiving the services that, to my understanding, as a community member, were due to them through these resettlement agencies. And that's when I decided to seek out opportunities to volunteer and contribute my resources and skill sets to help families like theirs. I should mention that there's a lengthy process that begins to any refugee from any country arriving to the United States. So I'd like to focus specifically on what happens once a family or an individual arrives to San Diego.
Yeah. What exactly is the role of the resettlement agencies in the resettlement process? What are they responsible for?
Sure. The San Diego Health and Human Services Agency has published a very nice and concise document that's available on their website. And within this document, there's a flowchart that explains the resettlement process that typically lasts between 30 and 90 days once an individual arrives to San Diego. And this begins with being connected with their resettlement agency and the caseworker through that resettlement agency. Mm-hmm. First, of course, they are welcomed at the airport and they're taken to housing, whether that be temporary housing or permanent housing. The resettlement agency is supposed to provide a culturally appropriate meal for the family and 2 to 3 days of food so that they can manage the first few days. From there, the process begins of obtaining social security numbers, cards, enrolling in public benefits such as CalWORKs, CalFresh, Medi-Cal, and WIC as appropriate. And there's also refugee assistance for those who do not have children. And in this process of obtaining and enrolling in benefits, families are supposed to receive additional supports from their resettlement agency. And these are outlined in documents that are signed initially when a refugee is matched with a resettlement agency. I'd like to point out just one of the lists in which one of the 4 resettlement agencies has outlined their responsibilities once they have connected with a refugee family. So again, once the family is connected with their caseworker, they've been placed into housing, they've received food, and are in the process of getting important ID and public benefits. This specific resettlement agency lists that they're responsible for providing safe, affordable, and accessible permanent housing, providing clothing, furniture, and other basic necessities upon move-in to permanent housing, assisting with cultural orientation, completing health screening protocols, enrolling children in school, enrolling adults in English classes, and providing transportation to job trainings and job interviews. And again, this is supposed to occur within the first 30 days, and that period can be extended up to 90 days.
30 or even 90 days isn't a lot, but such as it is, how well are you seeing this process work?
Well, I know the answer is frustrating, but I think it's, you know, it varies from family to family and agency to agency, both in the amount of support an individual or families receive and also the quality of that support. In general, I'd like to talk about the trends that we have noticed, that families are placed into leases in which the rent is exorbitant for the housing that is provided.
San Diego is one of the most expensive housing markets in the nation now, so it's exceptionally challenging.
Absolutely. I mean, it's challenging for all San Diegans, and for somebody who is just starting out with perhaps a passport in their pocket, you know, to be faced with a contract of a rent around $2,000 for a one-bedroom space is quite daunting. From there, there seems to be a lack in terms of capacity and perhaps effort in ensuring that these homes are furnished, that families are provided with basic necessities from food in their refrigerator and pantries to some type of appropriate place to sleep, a place to eat, and then certainly everyday hygiene products, you know, that all of us would have in these homes. And then from there, it gets a bit more challenging in that within the 30 days to have an individual or a family have their child enrolled in school, to have adults enrolled in English classes, and then to offer the possibility of employment services or employment supports. Really, I have yet myself to see that happen within 30 days. And oftentimes that doesn't happen within that 90-day time frame, which is when most often refugee families reach out to community volunteers like us to kind of fill in those gaps.
Yeah, it's such a shame. These people have already gone through so much trauma. They've fled war and violence in their homeland only to come here and face a new round of hardships. So what are some of the barriers or challenges that are preventing these families from getting the support that's outlined by the county and by the resettlement agencies?
Sure. And just to address your last comment, I just want to acknowledge the validity of that. I've had more than one family tell me, and it's heartbreaking every time, that, you know, they question whether it was the best decision to bring their family to the United States despite facing death threats, you know, extreme violence, trauma, etc., in Afghanistan or in the country where they are from. One family told me that, you know, he thought that he was doing his best by being able to provide his family opportunity, but he's not sure whether it would have been more kind for his children to have died in an act of terrorism or to have been in the United States and starved to death. Oh my God. That's just the unfortunate reality of the situation. And so I think that there are several barriers as to why these families aren't receiving the adequate supports that they need to fully resettle and ultimately become self-sufficient in San Diego. I think this starts with capacity, that resettlement agencies in the county take in more individuals and more families than they can appropriately manage. I think that, you know, caseworkers do their best, and realistically,
they're overwhelmed.
Yes.
And more help is needed if for whatever reason they're not able or not willing to do it. This is where the rest of the community needs to step up. Some already are, but
more
needs to be done, obviously.
And I'd also like to just add that I think there's a very detrimental narrative in regards to refugees from Afghanistan, that these are people who are not wanting to work, people who are dishonest, people basically who are undeserving of being our neighbors.
A lot of them were people who helped our U.S. military. They were translators. They risked their lives and their families' lives, you know, to assist the American military.
Absolutely. And
Barbara's just dying to get a word in.
I just wanted to chime in on backtracking a little bit about the agencies and the caseworkers. The disparity is like from A to Z. Very few of them seem to really care about the Afghans and the other refugees that they help, but a great many that I have personally encountered often make disparaging comments about the families. And if a family is courageous enough to keep calling them and asking for help, then they begin to ghost the family.
Oh, no.
And then again, that's how the family ends up calling somebody in the community because they are not being helped by their caseworker.
Yeah, that's really troubling.
Yes, just a few days ago, I had a family share some concerns with me. And so I asked for permission to contact their caseworker. And so I did contact their caseworker. And the next day when I went back to the family to pick them up, to take them to an appointment, I was told that the caseworker called them and reprimanded them for involving someone else.
Wow.
And it's my feeling, if the caseworker was actually doing their job, my intervention would have been unnecessary.
Absolutely. It sounds like a real overhaul is needed of the system. But Barbara, I want to talk to you a little bit. I know you are a mother, grandmother, foster mom, community organizer, and activist from the 1970s on, that you volunteered with the Safe Harbors Network during the Trump presidency, and you took in a Russian family yourself who'd been released from detention back in 2017. And through that process, you learned a lot about how broken our immigration system is. Then in August of 2021, when Kabul fell, you volunteered right away with groups that were providing material things to the refugees, but yet you found out they wouldn't allow or encourage personal involvement or advocacy. So you and some others here who felt the families needed and deserved more have now gotten together, and you're helping in ways where the government and relief agencies have failed or left off. Is there a liaison where people who fall between the cracks can go or get help, these refugees?
There is nothing. There is absolutely nothing. And it's so frustrating when we are put in touch with a family or a family reaches out to us. We immediately try to contact their caseworker. Oftentimes, their limited involvement with the relief agency has ended, so they're just kind of out there, and they don't know where to go or who to contact. I have called Daryl Issa's office multiple times with specific issues.
Congressman Issa.
Congressman Daryl Issa, yes, in El Cajon. The first time I called, I had a really lovely conversation with his refugee representative, but subsequent calls just took me to voicemail, and I never heard back. Recently, I have reached out to Scott Peters and Sarah Jacobs, refugee representatives, because we see a looming crisis with the rental situation in these families. As Carolyn noted, the rents are $2,000 or above, and yet the effort to get these people employed is basically non-existent. Mm.
It's very troubling. What kind of response did you get from the congressional members' offices at Sarah Jacobs and Scott Peters' offices?
Yes, I had a nice conversation with both of their representatives, but they said to me that their hands are tied locally. Did I reach out to our local representatives or state representatives, and that they, in absence of passing the Afghan Adjustment Act, which was taken out of the budget last December and now isn't even being considered at all, that there is a possibility of Afghan deportations happening, if you can even imagine such a thing.
How could they even think of sending them back to Afghanistan with the Taliban takeover and the cruelty, the discrimination against women, and frankly, their lives would be at stake if they helped Americans and they're sent back there. Isn't that like a death sentence for some of these people?
Yes, it absolutely is, and it just breaks my heart to see how families are preoccupied with this worry about the possibility of being sent back.
And who's responsible for holding this up in Congress and not getting this done?
Well, at the risk of sounding partisan, the Republicans demanded that it be taken out of the Biden budget, and so it was taken out, and now it's not coming up for a floor vote. And the process itself for the refugees to get asylum we have many different categories of refugees, and I won't go into it, but some came with an SIV, which is Special Immigration Visa,
right,
and they're basically safe. But the others, multitudes of them, who could have had an SIV if there had been time to process them, are on humanitarian parole or TPS, temporary protected status. That will end, and so there is an attorney who just started helping people get their asylum petitions going and expedited so that they don't get caught in this deadline in August of this year.
So there's a process, but it's obviously very stressful for everybody. So Barbara, in the meantime, what are some of the kinds of things that you have been able to do to respond where the agencies have, as you put it, failed?
Well, my original volunteering consisted of delivering things to the families, and I was the hygiene person. So I would deliver a hygiene basket, leave it at the door, and make my escape, since we were really not supposed to be fraternizing. But after one young teen girl used toothpaste on her arm for a severe burn, and another family used Clorox bleach wipes on their child, we would show them what each and every product in the basket was for, and we would pantomime and meme and have laughs. And at that time, I realized that the family really needed somebody to listen to their story with compassion and empathy. Just listen.
Yeah, I'll say, I'm amazed they don't give them at least a handout that would be in their native language to tell them how these products should be used. It's just crazy. So what happens when the cash aid or ASIP,
yeah,
when that ends?
ASIP, as it was known, was an experimental program that started last March, and it included providing basic furniture for the family and rental assistance. The first 3 months, they paid 100%, the second 75%, then 50%, then 25%. It's a year later, and the 25% is ending. And in September, all of that supplemental rental assistance will be over, yet we're finding more and more of the families have not gotten employed. They don't have employment, or if they do have employment, it's part-time minimum wage. And we just see a real tsunami of rental issues coming our way.
So have there been evictions, or are you afraid there will be?
We have one family who has a possibility of being evicted. Lynn has been trying to help them find emergency rental money from various programs that are listed on the websites but aren't responding. However, yes, we do see evictions possible in the future over the summer.
Really troubling. So if any of our listeners out there have an affordable place that you would be willing to rent to one of these refugee families, or if you have a job that would be suitable, a good paying job for a refugee, how can they get in touch with you, Barbara, to share that information?
We don't have a website because we just gradually formed up. We found each other over the last year and a half. There are about a dozen of us. We all work on separate issues, and we meet at my house. We call it the hub. People can come there for food, clothing, shoes, bedding. But my name is Barbara Cummings, and my phone number is 619-316-6694.
I want to talk about some more about the jobs for the refugees, but also education. Some of these refugees coming over here had plenty of skills. They were highly educated. They were doctors, engineers, and so forth. Who is helping them to verify their credentials and try to do whatever is needed to get into similar fields here?
Well, it was shocking to me and the rest of my team when we found that none of the relief agencies are doing verification of transcripts. And there was one point where we needed the agency to verify this individual had been helped by the agency in order to waive the $350 fee to verify his transcript. The agency refused to give a letter to that individual saying that they once worked with him. It took several phone calls, and we eventually did get the letter so that we could go forward with getting his transcript verified and not paying the $350 fee.
What are some of the jobs that they're being offered? I know you've told me some sort of horror stories of highly skilled people being offered really menial labor type of jobs.
I personally do not know of a single refugee who has degrees who has been offered a job commensurate with their experience. I understand that the degrees are not transferable immediately. I should take that back. We have an attorney who recently got a job at the public defender's office, not as an attorney, but as a paralegal of sorts. But she is the only person that I know. And she didn't get it from the relief agency. She found the job on her own through another volunteer group.
Yeah, I know you've told me some of them, no matter how highly skilled and educated, they're being offered jobs, you know, as dishwashers.
Yes, this is true. I'm not going to use the alphabet names of these groups that are tasked with finding jobs and helping them with employment. But I personally have gone with refugees to these places. We have one man, he speaks five languages. He lectured at Kabul University, has a degree in business management. He has yet to get a return call, and it's been over a month, from this center that's supposed to be putting him in touch with a career counselor. We have a satellite designer. We have an architect. We have just every possible field you can think of, and they are just simply not getting the job help they need from the government. I'm not going to blame the relief agencies 100%. The government has failed colossally.
Sounds like we need a Senate hearing on this or something. You know, maybe you should reach out to the California senators and see what they if they can make something happen. Let's move on to Pat. Yeah. Pat Stratton is a retired public educator from Michigan who relocated here about 13 years ago. Most of her career was spent as a special education coordinator at an inner city school, where she developed a passion for advocating for those whose voices go unheard and whose needs are unaddressed. She also teaches people in need how to advocate for themselves to become successful. Recently, she's been advocating for the Afghan refugees right here in East County in San Diego. She has focused primarily on the education component and the resources to make that happen. So, Pat, can you tell me what sort of responses did you receive at first when you approached the agencies to help refugees learn about educational opportunities?
Well, I first got involved with the educational system here in connecting the refugees to the community college system when I was measuring for shoes over on 6th Street. And I met a young lady who asked me, she said, Pat, I want to go to college. Caught me off guard. And we talked, and I said, well, let's make that happen. So we went to City College and found out about all the grants and Pell grants and California Promise and the EOPS system, all these supports that are in place. And so she applied and she's attending and she's about to finish her first year. And in spite of living in three different hotels and finally getting permanent housing and being placed in an apartment 20 miles away from the community college and working about 30 hours a week, she is thriving and is carrying a 3.7 grade average. So realizing this, I started to think about this opportunity for others. So I contacted the different agencies and shared with them what the possibilities were. It explained how the Pell Grant could cover quite a few expenses in terms of some housing and some other things. And what I was met with was, these people need to get a job. Oh. And so I mentioned that you can do work study. I mentioned this young lady and how she worked 30 yeah. hours a week, but was still going to school yeah. full time.
Yeah, my own daughter went to a community college and she was working three jobs, you know, even at UCSD. She was doing part-time at UCSD, part-time at community college, and working two or three jobs at a time. So it can be done.
Oh, yes. Yes, most definitely. Mm-hmm. And Farzana, who happens to be this young lady, has actually motivated me to encourage others to do the same. Whenever I contact an agency and talk to a caseworker, I'm always quick to share about the educational opportunities and the grants and how it can work in conjunction with the job.
Yeah.
And I met with some real hesitation. I absolutely get no cooperation, and I've actually offered to speak to the caseworkers and explain to them how the system works, and have told them they can actually refer the people to me, and I will take them to the college and walk them through the FAFSA application.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so what sort of help do you provide now to refugees and their families that the agencies, for whatever reason, are not providing to help them navigate the educational system?
Well, actually, I pick them up and take them to the community college and see them through the making sure that their residency is approved, make sure that they follow the FAFSA steps correctly, meet with financial aid people, meet with counselors, meet with the admissions people. One husband and wife that I'm working with, I believe we were at the community college 4 days. They were anxious to get started, and they started their classes and are quite motivated to do so. And so very fortunately, they're going to qualify for Pell Grants and the California Grant and the EOPS support.
Very good.
So, and they can work part-time. So basically, that's what I do. And again, when I contact the worker, caseworker, to let them know what we're doing, one of the comments was, well, that's the problem. Everybody's out there doing their own thing, and then we can't do our job. And to which my response was, well, you aren't doing your job, so someone needs to.
Exactly. Yeah, it sounds like the whole system needs an overhaul. Some of the needs that are not being met seem so small. One of you, I know, mentioned before we went on the air about a refugee who just needed $90 for a CPR course that's required before they can start an EMT program. This was someone who had much higher medical skills in their homeland. How do you help with situations like that?
Okay, well, we actually have three people that are planning on taking the EMT program this summer, and we're able to get the tuition covered and the books and all the supplies. But one of the things that came up was that they need to take the BLS CPR course prior to the first day of class. So I called the agency that they are with, and I asked about this fee. I believe it was about $90. And they said, we don't do that. And I said, well, I don't quite understand. I thought you had job support money that could help. No, we don't do that. And so then we contacted PCG, because they have been, they're part of the job training program, and there are grants that they have.
What's PCG? What does that stand for?
PCG is Pacific Consulting Group, and they are supposed to be helping people who can't find jobs, but I personally have taken 3 people there and have yet to hear back from the Career Development Center after 5 weeks. So if I, as an advocate for a refugee, cannot get any movement, how in the world is a refugee without an advocate supposed to navigate this system regarding jobs?
Yeah, it seems to me this is an area where maybe there's probably a lot of people out there in the public who would like to help if they just knew that donating $90 would help make the difference in a refugee being able to get their EMT degree or not. I think there's people that would help. Is there some kind of a funding source, a place that people can donate if they want to help with that?
Well, supposedly, the funds have been given to the agencies to support situations like this, where we just need $90 for someone to be able to get this endorsement.
Yeah.
But every time they're approached, the response is, we don't do that.
So maybe a community nonprofit could step in here and fill this, you know, this void.
Well, that's a possibility, except, again, our experience has been that some of the nonprofits have obstacles and red tape and hoops that are preventing their programs from assisting the refugees. For example, I won't name the name, but they do provide grants, except that the refugee has to be referred to this group by their caseworker. But by the time the caseworker, by the time the refugee realizes, oh my, I really need to escalate my job search here, they don't have a caseworker, therefore the caseworker cannot get them to the program, and so that eliminates them from different things that would be available if their caseworker had been proactive during the time that they had the family and referred them to these various nonprofits, which they are not doing.
Sounds like maybe we just need GoFundMe, you know, somebody who would vet them to make sure it's real, and then put a GoFundMe site up, and I'll bet you the public would come up with that $90, you know, in a heartbeat if they knew there was this need. It's harder for large amounts, but for something that small, it seems like there should be a way. Venmo, yeah.
Okay, this is Barbara Cummings again. I will say my Venmo, and hopefully it will be on the East County Magazine site.
Yes.
And I'll give my phone number again. It's 619-316-6694. My Venmo is at Barbara-Cummings-25. I'm going to be doing a Facebook fundraiser for the refugee community. So if you want to look me up on Facebook, feel free to do so and contribute to my birthday fundraiser.
Well, happy birthday, Barbara.
Barbara, would it be possible, for example, if anyone who does choose to Venmo you or participate in your fundraiser, if they have a particular interest in funding a certain thing, could they designate
Absolutely.
That? Like on your Venmo,
Earmark.
Maybe say, oh, I heard about those three students that are planning on going into the EMT program, and I would like to pay for their Red Cross certification. Would you please use the money for that? Would that be acceptable?
Absolutely, and people do that on my Venmo. This is for refugee shoes. This is for school backpacks. This is for medication for the lady with diabetes. Anybody can earmark anything when they Venmo me.
Barbara, you've mentioned that government training money is not available for Afghans. Can you tell me about that?
I don't know why it's not available. That's the problem. I literally, in fact, all of us here have spent day after hour after day trying to dig up, uncover money. We have one gentleman who needs, he was offered a job as a medical translator, but he needed a certificate, a language certificate, and they wanted him to use a specific program called PRISM, but that program cost $1,050. So that was one of the reasons that I started calling our elected representatives to try to see if maybe they could direct me somewhere to come up with this money. And I came up dry and literally spent two full days on the phone.
How frustrating. It sounds like you're encountering a lot of obstacles to help these refugees meet their educational goals and get job placement. Well, it sounds like there's all kinds of obstacles facing these poor people coming over who've already been through so much. And I really want to thank and congratulate all three of you for caring enough to jump in and try to fill the void. But obviously, there's a lot more work to be done. I want to give each of you, you know, a final word here to let us know what kind of help, you know, they can provide. And if there's anything else I didn't already ask you about, feel free to throw that in. Lynn, let's start with you.
Thank you for this opportunity again. And I just want to emphasize that it does not take a specific skill set. It does not take a specific amount of financial resources, etc., that these families really need a kind and compassionate neighbor to help them navigate the systems that we have in our society. They're entirely different from what they're used to. And, you know, I've only found that these families are courteous, they are humble, they are hardworking, they're wanting to do the best for their families, just like all of us are.
Thank you for that. Pat, how about you?
I would like to echo what Lynn said. I have found each of these families to just want to do their best. They want to become contributing members of our country. They already talk about how much they love this country. They just want a chance, and those chances need to be offered by people. And I would just like to appeal to you that if by chance you know of a job or you can make a donation, I would hope that you would reach out to us, and we will see that we connect you with the person who is job hunting. It just takes all of us. These people are very interested in finding jobs and doing the very best for their family. They are hardworking, and they're looking to be positive members of our community.
Very good. Barbara, I'll let you have the last word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about the refugees in our community and the help that's needed for them?
We neglected to mention a whole segment that no one talks about, and those are the walkovers, the people that were left behind in Afghanistan when Kabul fell, have been hunted by the Taliban. They've been on the run. They've used up all their resources. Many of them got visas to Brazil and have made their way up through Central America and arrived at our border, and they're not being welcomed. They get zero support. They get no SNAP. They don't get a work permit, and they beg for places to stay. My group and I are helping four of these walkovers. We are feeding them.
Are these people that are waiting to have asylum claims?
Yes, they're waiting. They're waiting to be seen in our immigration court.
So a different category than refugees, but still certainly equally, maybe even more in need of help.
Definitely in need of help. One of them has a hearing on the 11th, and he actually is an SIVCOM refugee, which is the highest status. Yeah. However, since he did not enter legally, he cannot exercise that status. I have three other men who do not have standing, but who were threatened by the Taliban. One young man is, a videographer, and his whole class was murdered by the Taliban. So he was able to escape and was taken in by another refugee who can barely feed himself. Again, we've been feeding them, providing them with clothing, providing them with transportation, and we even have two people who have hired a lawyer and are spending $10,000 of their own money for this young man. So please think about the walkovers, and if you do have a few dollars to throw our way, again, at Barbara-Cummings-25.
And could you give us your phone number one more time? We're speaking with Barbara Cummings.
Yes, my phone number is 619-316-6694.
Well, this was our first conversation on this issue, but I'm hoping that it won't be the last, because it sounds like there's an ongoing series of problems that really need solutions. And I want to thank you on behalf of really everyone in our community for having such big hearts and doing what you can to try to help the refugees in our community. Thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much for hosting us today, Miriam, and we really appreciate the wide reach that East County Magazine and podcast has.
Thank you. Yeah, we will be, for those of you that may have tuned in late, we will be putting the entire podcast up on our website at eastcountymagazine.org.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.